The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, The Boom of Glenwood South. Multiple developers at downtown Raleigh's most visited quadrants are trying to reimagine the area, this time with tall residential towers and a push for a neighborhood feel. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, New chapter looms for rowdy Glenwood South as the location becomes a target for major investments, written by Caleb Harshberger. For years, the Cornerstone Tavern on Glenwood Avenue has been a go-to spot for raucous weekend crowds at Glenwood South's booming bar scene. The neighborhood has spent decades building a reputation for its weekend crowds and influx of bars and clubs out of what was once a sleepy and industrial part of town, but all that has started to change. Case in point is the Cornerstone Cavern, situated on a property now slated for a pair of high-end mixed-use towers by longtime Raleigh developer Joe Meir. Plans for those towers, dubbed the Madison and 603 Glenwood, came out last year and call for 11 stories of residential and office space over retail. They're just two of the five high-end mixed-use towers planned for Glenwood South, with the potential to transform the sometimes rowdy district into a more upscale commercial corridor packed with week-long foot traffic from office workers and residents in high-end apartments. It's similar to what we've seen in the Warehouse District. It's the next submarket, says Jason Davis, managing director at Turnbridge Equities, the developer behind the Creamery project. There are certainly a lot of folks drawn to the submarket for the same reasons, he says. Meanwhile, property owners along Glenwood South have begun positioning their properties for future development interest, while others are making the most of record-high investor demand. On New Year's Eve, a Maryland developer sold its Glenwood South project, dubbed Block 83, for $330 million, the largest price in downtown Raleigh history. The change could create opportunities for businesses that once may have thought it too hard to attract enough businesses throughout the week, as the influx of office workers could reshape the area into a more upscale commercial district. Still, with the COVID-19 Omicron variant spreading through the country, there remains a number of open questions and potential wrinkles for existing businesses to iron out in the months and perhaps years to come. Decades in the making. Long before it was known as Glenwood South, the working-class neighborhood was made up of a loose collection of blocks, mostly populated by a smattering of single-family homes and squat commercial buildings. That changed in the 1990s when businesses moved in, eyeing cheaper rents and access to percolating urban populations nearby. It was all grassroots businesses initially, small entrepreneurs and restaurateurs that wanted and could lease older buildings that were available, says Ann Cable Baum, owner of the Glenwood Agency Real Estate Company. It was never the hub of downtown, but Glenwood South was the cool, trendy place. Businesses opened in older commercial buildings or converted homes to house offices or shops, and the area began attracting interest from developers. Apartment and condo buildings began popping up in the city around that time, drawing foot traffic from nearby growing neighborhoods. Eventually, developers began bringing apartments and condominiums to Glenwood South itself. Baum and a number of Glenwood South businesses and residents formed a group to attract people back to the district. That's when the name Glenwood South was born. And as always, local businesses continued fueling the bustling character of the neighborhood. It was really all the business owners who leased space in the smaller buildings. Frankly, it still is the cool, trendy place, Baum says. I know the bars and clubs and stuff like that have kind of taken over. But the area is changing and more is on the way. I know we're quickly getting rid of our character and charm, she says, but I guess those are the growing pains of a city. One entrepreneur who has seen the neighborhood change is Alex Amra. He moved to the Triangle in 2000 and eventually found work at Sullivan's in Glenwood South. I used to be an aircraft inspector for Midway Airlines. After September 11, they went belly up, and now I own restaurants, he says. I always tell people after 9/11, I'm of Palestinian descent. We all of a sudden became terrorists, so I couldn't get a job. We're immigrants, and we had that American initiative. After a stint in Houston, Amra returned to the Triangle to work with his brothers, first with a cigar bar and then with what has become a fixture of Glenwood South. Alex, Brian, and Rami Amra launched Tobacco Road Sports Cafe and Brewery in 2008. We're big sports fans, and we always wanted to open a restaurant, Alex Amra says. Whenever you'd want to go watch a game, you could only get fried food. We thought, we've got to do this better. 90% of our menus are locally sourced. The brothers ultimately opened three locations in Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. Neighbors' bars clash. Meanwhile, Glenwood South continued to build a reputation for its growing bar scene, at times to the consternation of local residents as developers crammed more units into the district. According to Downtown Raleigh Alliance data, the district is the densest in Raleigh with 2,900 units per acre across the neighborhood's roughly 0.28 miles. That comes out to 16.3 residential units per acre. Since 2015, the DRA found that developers had delivered 1,679 residential units in Glenwood South, with 266 units currently under construction and 752 units planned or proposed. This makes up around a third of downtown Raleigh's residential pipeline. This influx of residents has sometimes clashed with the businesses, as evidenced by a steady stream of noise complaints and petitions to the city to rein in what some residents say are overly loud and disruptive bars and businesses in the neighborhood. And even when businesses are willing to work with clients, the clientele can sometimes cause problems when outside. One group that's on the front lines of these conversations is the Glenwood South Neighborhood Collaborative, which looks to bring residents and businesses together to strengthen the community and encourage communication. Collaborative President Larry Miller and his wife moved from Cary to Glenwood South in 2014 to find a more urban place to live. Miller says the GSNC puts on a slew of artistic and community activities while fostering community in the neighborhood. It also looks to balance the needs and interests of the residents with those of the businesses that draw so much prosperity to Glenwood South. The group continues to urge residents to call a business before resorting to phoning the police, though Miller says things still occasionally escalate. I encourage people to do that because most of the businesses are reasonable, whether they can turn the music down or turn the speakers, he says. But if someone just calls and says, you're too loud, let's just say there are certain businesses that get more complaints than others. The pandemic hasn't made it easier. At first, the crowds were gone and businesses were left to wonder about the future. By summer, business came roaring back and crowds of customers rushed into Glenwood South each weekend. For residents, it came with some mixed feelings. We're leading the recovery in Raleigh, but there are some side effects. The noise, Miller says. The bars here, after being closed completely for months, took advantage of that to expand their outdoor spaces and set up tents and speakers out there, he adds. The city didn't complain about that because they'd been closed down for a long time, and this was a way to get them back and operating again. The downside is, if you have all the businesses and customers moving outside, that's where the noise is. Meanwhile, challenges remain for bars and restaurants as the labor shortage persists and costs rise. At Tobacco Road Sports Cafe and Brewery, Amra says he and his brothers had to close the Chapel Hill location and struggle to staff the other two. Meanwhile, he says they're doing what they can to deal with rising supply costs without passing too much of that onto the customer. Despite the tension in Glenwood South, he says the residents and businesses have learned to get along even amid the rapid growth in the district. At the beginning, it was tough. At first, everyone didn't want to talk. They just wanted to scream, Amra says. But you get people to talk, it's become more of a neighborhood. Amid this backdrop, a third group is about to change the dynamic as developers bring a new class of construction to the neighborhood. It has the potential to change the district forever. Influx of office towers. Heritage Properties partner Ryan Blair's first experiences with Glenwood South came in his college days at NC State University 2 decades ago. He spent 5 years in Baltimore after landing a job with Heritage Properties. By 2015, the company wanted to push into Raleigh, and Blair was tapped to lead it. Heritage set its sights on Glenwood South in a location that would become Block 83. Prior to us starting Block 83, there was a limited supply of parking, and we solved that, he says. There was a limited supply of hotels. Now you have the Hampton Inn, AC Marriott, Origin Hotel, and another one planned. Now you have 2,400 more apartments that are less than 10 years old. By 2018, the company's first tower, One Glenwood, opened to tenants, followed 2 years later by Tower 2. The success of the project and the surge of interest in Glenwood South led City Office REIT of Canada to pay $330 million for the project. Meanwhile, nearby residents such as Smoky Hollow and the Dillon brought more business into the area. All this means foot traffic is shifting from heavy weekends and light on the weekdays to week-long surges from office workers. When I was in college, there wasn't enough office product or people in Glenwood South for the daytime demand, Blair says. So all those businesses thrived and depended on the bar scene. That's totally shifting. It's the street with the most character in downtown Raleigh, and that's not going to change. Now, a restaurant can survive, so you're not going to see as many bars, he says. You're going to see a broader mix. Still, all this growth won't be a boon for everyone as the corridor grows. The influx of high-end real estate is putting immense pressure on housing affordability. Across the triangle, housing demand in prime urban corridors like Glenwood is slamming into the ongoing housing shortage as a flood of newcomers deploy tech and life sciences salaries to land prime homes, condos, and apartments in the city. According to a submarket analysis by Rich Realty Group owner Marshall Rich, home prices in Glenwood South jumped from a median price of $402,000 in 2020 to $437,000 in 2021. That's up from 2019's median price of $420,750 and 2018's median price of $359,000. Condos saw a notable boom too, despite naysayers continually warning that over the last 2 years of the pandemic-related backlash against urban living. One property, 222 Glenwood, saw prices skyrocket, with median sales prices jumping from $332,450 in the first half of the year to $405,000 by the close. All that, even as new homes and units continued to pour into the neighborhood, sending sales volume soaring from 178 closed in 2020 to 264 closed in 2021. That is strong for just 6 months' time, Rich says. Across Raleigh as a whole, home prices closed out 2021 with a 21.4% bump from the year before, according to data by Redfin. All this could mean the makeup of the neighborhood could be changing as property values and therefore taxes continue to rise. Meanwhile, the area continues to attract upscale development. Up the road from Block 83, New York developer Turnbridge Equities is eyeing a summer start to its redevelopment of the Creamery property, with plans for a 32-story residential tower and 20-story office tower. The developer has committed to preserving the historic structure that currently sits at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Tucker Street. To the north, longtime Raleigh developer Joe Mears Blue Heron Realty has filed plans for a pair of towers, including an 11-story apartment tower called the Madison and a 12-story office tower called 603 Glenwood. All this additional high-end office and high-end residential product has the potential to reshape the types of businesses that can find success in Glenwood South. Amra says he could see the new office and high-end residential making a huge difference for the neighborhood and for his business, which now relies on weekend traffic. And that's what kills us. People come down on the weekend. People say, oh my God, it's so busy. This is great. But it's just 2 days, and that's what kills me, he says. In the meantime, businesses continue to pour into the district. According to data by DRA, Glenwood South saw a major resurgence of business opening, with a last year seeing 20 new businesses and just 5 business closings. That compares to 18 openings and 16 closings in 2020. In addition to the planned towers of Turnbridge Equities and Blue Heron Realty, landowners along Glenwood have asked for zoning changes. Raleigh firm Centerline Properties LLC filed a request to rezone an assemblage at 300, 304, and 306 Glenwood Avenue and 509 and 519 West North Street to allow for development up to 40 stories tall. And just recently, representatives for LLC's address to Raleigh-based Tuscany Construction held a neighborhood meeting regarding a potential rezone for 4 parcels at 107, 117, 123, and 125 Glenwood, also seeking a 40-story zoning change. Waiting for change. For all the promises of week-long hustle and bustle of high-paid residents and workers in Glenwood, the changes are in their infancy, and one ongoing wrinkle is the impact COVID continues to have on companies' work-from-home policies. For businesses such as Tobacco Road, the boom can't come soon enough. People are getting scared again, man. I can tell, Amra says. We still have little parties here and there. They're getting smaller. These days, he's focused on keeping his business alive through the pandemic. You know, you used to think that far out, but the way things are going, you're just trying to get staff here today, Amra says. What am I going to be today? Am I going to be a host today? Am I going to be a cook today? For residents such as Miller, there is some hope that the new changes bring a calmer neighborhood and maybe the added density will soak up some of the noise. As long as it doesn't lose that community feel, I think it will be good, Miller says. And now we return to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. The headline, expanding its brand in rural North Carolina. Quixote Tractor leans into its Korean heritage and sees its business triple over the last 5 years. Written by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. While 1 in 5 Asian Americans said they experienced an incident of hate in 2021, there's been no sign of anti-Asian sentiment nor shunning at Quixote Tractor in Wendell, the North American headquarters of privately held Daedong Corporation, which is located in Daegu, South Korea. Quixote's business tripled over the last 5 years, most dramatically over the last 2 years. That growth translated to roughly 20,000 tractors out the door in 2021, and sales are projected to increase significantly again this year. Positioning the company as a multicultural brand, proudly Korean-American, has proved a winning strategy. Our company is uniquely blended with about 95% American workers and about 5% Korean expats, Chief Operating Officer Anna Kim says. She joined the company 18 years ago, having grown up in Korea before attending college in the U.S. She is not related to Kyoto President and CEO Peter Dong-kyu Kim. The small number of expats in the leadership that came here show us a great example of the Korean culture, which is a good thing, she says, describing the Korean influence as one of perseverance, great loyalty for the company, and an amazing work ethic. From an HR perspective, we hired local employees and tried to localize Quixote Tractor in Daedong, USA, into Wendell and the neighboring communities. A lot of American culture was adopted. The creativities of American employees, their empowerment, and their passion were well integrated with the Korean culture. It's the ideal work environment where people are working passionately, relentlessly, and loyally. We have a special connection between Korean and American employees and a really great culture where people work hard and play hard. Employees are encouraged to socialize with one another out of work, and everyone is given their birthday as a holiday along with a gift certificate for a dinner celebration. Once people have a connection with one another, the initial differences we forget, Kim says. We concentrate on content and substance of work, and managers are given budgets to use to build teamwork, so we have overcome the challenges that other multicultural companies have. As part of the essential agriculture industry, Quixote maintained its operations throughout COVID and supported its employees who worked on-site by providing them with free meals. Anecdotally, the pandemic also helped accelerate the company's growth, since the majority of Quixote customers are what Greg Beebe, Director of Strategic Sales and Marketing, describes as rural lifestylers. During the pandemic, some city residents were inspired to take social distancing quite literally and relocate to rural areas or large tracts of land. Pew Research reported in December that more people left American cities for other U.S. communities than moved into cities during 2020, which Pew said continued a pre-pandemic trend. Americans are less likely than before the pandemic to want to live in cities. About 1 in 5 say this now, compared with roughly 1 in 4 in 2018, the report concluded. However, the report also noted that the number of people who moved into rural places in 2020 was 800,000, compared with an annual average of 1 million prior to the pandemic, although this could also be attributed to the fact that Americans relocated less during the pandemic than in years past. Only 8% of Americans moved between March 2020 and March 2021, the lowest rate since the government began reporting the data more than 70 years ago. A tremendous number of our products are sold to hobby farmers, and that customer base has been driving our growth over the last couple of years as people increasingly move out of cities to where they can have 2, 5, maybe 10 acres of land. Now they have to take care of their property, and a compact tractor is like a Swiss Army knife. It can do many things using different attachments, Beebe says. Coyote tractors were also used in large farms and ranches across America, as well as on construction sites and with landscaping crews. But small farms are the fastest growing market segment. Within the agriculture industry, a focus on American-made products has traditionally resonated strong across U.S. markets, but Coyote builds its brand around its multicultural heritage and doesn't shy away from its Korean roots. People realize South Korea is known for producing strong products, and the country has a relationship with the U.S. as a strong ally, BB says. A lot of our products are made in Korea, and a lot of our components are sourced from North America. This company is about celebrating what brings us together and how we're similar, more than looking at what makes us different. The products are sold through roughly 500 independent dealership locations across North America, and most of those dealerships are locally owned family businesses that are firmly established within their communities. While the agriculture industry is perceived to be male-dominated, among hobby farmers and rural lifestylers, women often play a bigger decision in the buying process, and Coyote has proactively engaged women in management and across its dealer network. The company is looking to aggressively expand its dealer network, and it has begun to build out its corporate management to bring some of the product development to the North American headquarters. Our 3 to 5 year plan is to have some research and development as well as assembly being done from this facility, and we have already started hiring people for product development, Kim says. As we've grown and become a bigger part of the Daedong corporate business, product definition and development are going to come more and more from North America, BB says. We've made some key hires, particularly on the product management side, so we can start developing the roadmap specific to North America. Coyote moved from Wilson, where it was originally located, to a 35-acre campus in Wendell in 2004. Distribution facilities are also located in Mexia, Texas, and in Mississauga, Ontario, and Coyote recently rented a warehouse in Rocky Mount. The company considered a second North American headquarters, perhaps in Oregon, but Kim says, because most of the brain function is done here in North Carolina, we really hope to develop further expansion here. As far as R&D goes, we would like to stay in this area because right here between RTP and Eastern North Carolina, we are at the intersection of technology and agriculture, BB says. It's a really unique place for us to be in terms of the knowledge base, workforce, and the research at the universities. And we have two short news items in the 52 Shades of Success section. New requirement for CDFI fund applicants. The Community Development Financial Institutions, or CDFI Fund, announced a change in its processes effective immediately. As of 2022, all award applicants are asked to complete a Title VI compliance worksheet annually when they file an application. This requirement applies to award applicants as well as their prospective subrecipients that are not direct beneficiaries of federal financial assistance, for example, depository institution holding company and their subsidiary depository institutions. The CDFI fund will utilize the worksheet to determine if award applicants are compliant with federal civil rights requirements as required by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The worksheet is an online form that can be submitted through the CDFI fund's Award Management Information Systems, AMIS, at cdfifund.gov. Racial disparities among gig service workers. The gig workforce is growing, especially among Latinx, Black, and Asian Americans. Pew Research reports that 16% of U.S. adults have earned income through an online gig platform, but racial and ethnic differences abound when it comes to who does gig work, which includes deliveries from restaurants, retail stores, or grocers, performing household errands, driving for a ride-sharing app, or using a personal vehicle to deliver packages. Latinx adults are most likely to have done gig work. 30% report they have earned money through an online gig platform. 20% of Black adults and 19% of Asian adults report doing likewise, compared with 12% of white adults. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. NC sees surge in new businesses. North Carolina saw a surge of new businesses in 2021. Last year, 178,300 new businesses were started in the state, outpacing every other year on record and jumping more than 50,000 over 2020, according to the North Carolina Secretary of State's office. The 2021 figure is more than double the 84,000 new businesses the state saw in calendar year 2017. North Carolina is a hotbed of folks eager and willing to make their own way no matter what the pandemic throws their way. Secretary of State Elaine Marshall says this is the second year in a row that many of our friends and neighbors have shown they have the drive and determination to start their own business, and that is a huge boost to our state and local economies. Marshall's department also says a recent survey found 90% of businesses created either 1, 2, or 3 years ago are still operating. Half of the entire survey sample reported revenues of more than $25,000, with 9% reporting revenues over $500,000. The survey also showed more new business creators were minority-owned, women-owned, and younger. New leader named for the state's craft beer industry. The North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild has a new leader. Lisa Parker was named executive director of the guild following the retirement of Rich Green at the end of 2021. "We couldn't be more excited to have Lisa step into this new role," says Micah Neubauer, vice president of the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild and the CEO co-founder of Southern Pines Brewing Company. "Lisa has passionately served our craft breweries for years, and she will do a wonderful job continuing the Guild's legacy of impact and furthering the community aspect that makes this industry so special to our state." A North Carolina native, Parker has worked with the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild since 2015, most recently holding the position of associate director. Help for small business owners. Small business owners in Raleigh who are looking for a lift can apply for the city's Building Up Fit grant program through January 30. The program assists with funding for renovations, additions, and development at commercial properties. Potential improvements include costs associated with bringing the building up to code, flooring and lighting, construction or demolition of walls and roofing. For example, Oak City Fish and Chips owner Isaac Horton used the funds to outfit a new brick-and-mortar location in Southeast Raleigh. Pandemic has an impact on hotels. Hotel occupancy and room rates from Charlotte's Duke's Mayo Bowl on December 30 remained well below pre-pandemic levels, according to a report from the Charlotte Business Journal. The report cites data from industry tracker STR. The game featured an appealing matchup between UNC Chapel Hill and the University of South Carolina, with attendance coming in at 45,520 at the 75,000 capacity stadium. A year ago, capacity was limited to friends and family at 1,500 people. According to STR, the game created demand for a combined 7,460 rooms on December 29 and 30. That equates to an occupancy rate of 58.2% in Uptown Charlotte, which has 6,405 hotel rooms. The average room rate paid by guests was $184.73, but occupancy was down nearly 28% from 2019, when the University of Kentucky played Virginia Tech in front of 44,138 fans. Effort will try to keep workers home. Earlier this year, Johnston County started a new website, jococareers.org, aimed at better connecting job seekers with employers. And there's another motive, too, keeping Johnston County residents in the county for work. About 51.5% of Johnston County residents commute outside the county for work, according to data from the North Carolina Department of Commerce. "Ours is a county in rapid transition," says Chris Johnson, director of the Johnston County Office of Economic Development. "We're a popular destination for new residents and home to an expanding base of industries and new jobs. But these two very positive trends are not always in alignment. JocoCareers.org is designed to connect our growing population with exciting employment opportunities closer to home." Johnston County was the fastest growing county in North Carolina during the 2010s, according to U.S. Census data. And finally, two groups to build 1,700 homes. The Durham Housing Authority has selected two groups to lead development on three downtown sites with a total investment of $470 million. The Integral Group LLC will lead the redevelopment of the Forest Hill Heights community with plans for 700 mixed-income residential units and 73,000 square feet of commercial space. And Durham Development Partners will lead the work on both Fayette Place and the DHA Office and Criminal Justice Resource Center CJRC sites, with plans calling for more than 1,000 mixed-income residential units, a 42,000-square-foot office building, and a 20,000-square-foot retail parcel across two sites. That group is a joint venture team of F7 International Development, Greystone Affordable Development, and Gilbane Development Company. The plans would bring more than 1,700 residential units, including 900 affordable units, at 30 to 80% area median income to the city. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Finance page, written by Lauren Onasorge. Colopy's next quest? Back more startups. Bronto founder Colopy raises $20 million in Jurassic Capital Fund. Nearly 7 years after selling Durham's Bronto software to NetSuite for $200 million, serial entrepreneur Joe Colopy and his new fund have raised $20 million. Jurassic Capital, whose name is a play on Bronto, the email marketing firm Colopy bootstrapped with co-founder Chas Felix, launched 2 years ago. Colopy confirms the initial closing of the inaugural fund, Jurassic Capital Growth Fund 1, at more than $20 million in investor commitments. Colopy says the team had been working to secure the capital for about 6 months. It's our first fund, he says. Even though we have made a number of investments, we haven't done it organized under a fund. Jurassic Capital is meant to fill a gap for bootstrapped business-to-business software startups seeking capital. It targets firms with between $1 million and $5 million in annual recurring revenue that aren't just looking for cash. Jurassic is also looking for entrepreneurs in search of operational expertise and mentorship. I'm not looking for new shiny things, Colopy says. I'm looking for companies that have been running, that have good operations. They're looking to scale what they're doing from a sales perspective and do more of what they're already doing. Since Jurassic Capital started investing in 2019, its portfolio has grown to include firms such as Ad Shoppers, CoreVist, and Performance Culture. The new fund includes capital for Performance Culture, as well as another startup to be announced soon, Colopy says. Colopy co-founded Bronto with Felix over pints of Guinness in 2002. Execs, business environment is selling point. When it comes to winning investment in the Triangle, it will take more than talking points about livability, particularly those about how close Raleigh is to the beach. Yes, we have a great lifestyle, but we are the best place for talent and growth, said Cindy Eckert, founder of Raleigh-based accelerator, The Pink Ceiling. That, she said, should be the Triangle story, and it's the executives who need to tell it every chance they get. Eckert, the serial entrepreneur behind companies such as Sprout Pharmaceuticals, was one of the speakers at January's Launch 2022 event sponsored by the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. Eckert told the crowd she's had plenty of conversations about the area with big-name friends, from Damon John of ABC's Shark Tank show to California-based venture capitalist Kirsten Green of Forerunner Ventures. When Eckert asked them about the region, they all said, "Oh, that area is cool." But they also said, "I don't know anything about the business environment." Eckert said CEOs need to brag with statistics, talk about how it's the number one place to start a small business when Raleigh ranks number one on a list. Open with that, she said. Do not say we're 1 hour from the beach and 2 hours from the mountains, she said. It isn't going to bring the dollars. What will bring the dollars to the area is when they recognize just how much we're kicking ass. Supreme Court rejects appeal by Peters. Stephen Peters, the Raleigh financier currently serving prison time after being convicted of a long-running Ponzi scheme, has failed in his attempt to get the U.S. Supreme Court to hear his appeal. On January 10, the court notified Peters that his petition for what's called a writ of certiorari has been denied. But the chance the high court would hear the case was always a long shot. The Supreme Court gets between 7,000 and 8,000 of these petitions each term, but only takes up about 1% of them. Peters was convicted of orchestrating a $15 million Ponzi scheme through his Raleigh finance firm, VisionQuest. And in a section called He Said It, the quote is from Harry Davis, an economist with the North Carolina Bankers Association, speaking at the 20th Annual Economic Forecast Forum this month. The minimum wage in the United States is set by Walmart and Amazon and Starbucks. And finally, we have a section called By the Numbers. $0. The amount collected by Arch Capital of the $6.8 million incentives grant offered by the state of North Carolina when the firm picked Raleigh over Atlanta for a 365-job expansion in 2018. The incentives were terminated after Arch notified officials that it would be unable to meet employment and investment targets. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Bramette. Ghost kitchens rise during the pandemic. Jason Johnson is in expansion mode with Hub Kitchens model. Ghost kitchen operator Jason Johnson is expanding his company's reach in the Triangle, capitalizing on a business model that has accelerated during the pandemic. His second Raleigh location is opening soon at 1214 East Lenore Street, and a kitchen at Raleigh-Durham International Airport is set to open in March, he says. Next, he'll open a Durham location in May and a third Raleigh location in August before rounding it out with another Durham location in December. In addition to growing his company, Hub Kitchens, to 6 locations this year, Johnson is also launching a crowdfunding campaign to support the growth. "We saw crowdfunding as a new opportunity versus the traditional bank loan route," he says. Hub Kitchens currently has one ghost kitchen, a site where food is prepared for delivery, open at 1129 Corporation Parkway in Raleigh. The company says it has 42 active clients, over 500 applicants wanting space, and has seen 4 entrepreneurs become full-time business owners. The crowdfunding campaign is offering an 8.5% equity stake for a total raise of $467,550. Over $22 billion in funding has been invested in ghost kitchen companies, according to PitchBook. It's a $43.1 billion industry, says Hospitality Technology, and is projected to grow to $71.4 billion by 2027. Johnson is also helping run the newly announced Raleigh Main Street program, along with Raleigh Founded, Downtown Raleigh Alliance, and Incolo. The accelerator program aims to help minority and disadvantaged individuals start food and beverage companies in a food hall on Fayetteville Street. Grocers continue fight for consumers. In a time of supply chain issues, labor shortage woes, and the decline of brick-and-mortar retail, grocery stores are weathering the storm. In recent months, 8 new stores opened, with 7 more coming soon in 11 Triangle towns and cities. In the August through September period, Triangle real estate transactions included at least 12 grocer-anchored shopping centers, proving groceries' popularity. In November, Garner drew crowds as the state's largest Costco opened at 7800 Fayetteville Road, and Wegmans has a 5th Triangle location planned for Holly Springs at NC Highway 55 and Ralph Stevens Road. Florida-based Publix announced its first Durham location at the Marketplace at Ellis Crossing Shopping Center at the corner of Watchorn Street and Ellis Road. In early December, the company also opened a 2-story store in Wendell, with a 2nd Eastern Wake County location already in the works for Rollsville. Mitch's Tavern set to reopen near NC State. Hillsborough Street's Mitch's Tavern has been closed since the start of the pandemic. With the help of a new management team, the legendary spot is set to reopen as early as February. Mitch Hazori will continue as the principal owner, but the group running Mojo's Burger Joint is set to take over running the tavern, according to City Plat's Pat Moore. The 47-year-old tavern is located directly across from NC State University's main campus. Along with the tavern, the group is gaining an empty downstairs bar area, with plans to open it as well. And in a section called He Said It, we have a quote from Charlie Coyne, CBRE Raleigh Senior Vice President, on the former Spanky's building in Chapel Hill being sold to Raising Cane's. "This sale represents a new chapter for the property and Franklin Street." And finally, a big number, 3.3 million square feet. That's the amount of storage space Raleigh has added since 2010, a Rent Cafe report says. In December, the action continued with an $80 million storage facility swap between 2 public real estate investment trusts. Buyer Public Storage operates over 170 million square feet of rentable space. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. Charitable donations are down for North Carolina because of COVID's impact. State report reveals the pandemic's effects on charitable donations. This is written by Laura Bramette. Giving was down last year in North Carolina by $10.8 million, according to the year-end report from the state. The 2020 to 2021 Charitable Solicitation Licensing Division report shows in the period between July 2020 and June 2021, fundraisers raised more than $34 million, a 30% plus decline from previous year's mark of $44.9 million. For each donation amount recorded, the report shows how much of the funds went to the organization's actual mission instead of solicitor or charity overhead costs. The total percentage of money going to charity programs also decreased this year to 78.07% from 80.53% though last year's numbers was a record high. North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall notes the pandemic and its economic and social impact as the cause of the decline in giving. Organizations had to figure out other ways to fundraise, she says. They couldn't have sporting events where people come together. They couldn't have banquets. They couldn't have dances and galas. So a lot of them are dependent upon one big event of the year to raise their money. In the earlier months, people were unsure about how the pandemic would affect the economy, she says. The uncertainty surrounding areas such as job stability caused potential donors to keep their money close to home. In addition, the report also tracks totals for multi-state and national fundraising campaigns that involve North Carolinians. These campaigns brought in a total of $1.03 billion, a $100 million decrease from the previous year. The percentage of donations going to missions dropped to 74.9% compared to 2019 to 2020's record high of 86.6%. I totally think we'll bounce back, Marshall says. The charities are still in need, and we certainly hope that people will resume and even expand their giving. Our goal is to make sure that it goes to the ones that are really worthwhile and really serving the public as opposed to those who are inefficient or outright fraudsters. The report has been published for 21 years, and its purpose is to help both charities and contributors make wise decisions, Marshall says. Looking at the percentage of donated money going toward the mission sheds light on where donor money is going and can show organizations which fundraising groups result in the most money given to programs. The report doesn't show how much of the funds that don't end up in organizations' purses are going toward solicitor costs compared to charity overhead. However, nonprofit organization Form 990 tax documents show financial details, including details about the contracts made with solicitors. According to federal law, North Carolina is unable to establish a minimum percentage that must be given to charity programs. Giving money is considered free speech, Marshall says. What we're really regulating is the profession of professional fundraising, but there are a lot of exempt organizations, she says. North Carolina law is a little bit like Swiss cheese. It's got a bunch of exceptions. The Secretary of State's office bases licensing on if charities and nonprofit organizations use professional fundraisers, compensate their officers, or raise at least $25,000 a year. However, organizations such as religious institutions, school-based nonprofits, and volunteer fire departments are exempt from licensure. It's most important that people do their research so that their dollars get the maximum bang for the buck, Marshall says. My tip that I frequently give people is not to respond to email solicitations that you don't know the organization and came out of the blue, she says. The secretary also recommended going through local organizations when giving, even when the charity or cause is a national or international one. And in the nonprofit briefs, three Carey women get a day to re-energize. Three women, Sammy Thompson, Little Garcia, and Ann Jeffrey Walensky, were selected for Preston Dental Loft's fifth Carey Cares makeover. Thompson is the director of a substance abuse and mental health clinic. Garcia is a mother of eight children who works the third shift at a hospital and is finishing her nursing degree. Jeffrey Walensky is a single mother of three, and she faces a variety of health issues. Each received a prize package valued at more than $1,100 that includes manicures, lunch, haircuts, and a full dental consultation and teeth whitening from Preston Dental Loft. We are grateful to all our local partners for coming together to create a campaign to help these women feel special, Preston Dental Loft owner Dr. Meenal Patel said. NC State Group gets grant to aid broadband efforts. The Institution for Emerging Issues, or IEI, at NC State University has been awarded a $2 million grant from the Dogwood Health Trust to support its Building a New Digital Economy in North Carolina, or BAND NC program. The grant will target North Carolina's 18 westernmost counties. Ensuring that communities across the state have proper access to broadband and have a deeper understanding of the benefits of adopting digital technologies are essential components of our economic vitality, Chancellor Randy Woodson said. Band NC provides many grants to communities across the state that are implementing digital inclusion plans. The new project will focus on developing sustainable digital inclusion plans as IEI will work closely with regional governments. Research shows that greater adoption of broadband in home leads to a better health outcome, stronger economic development, and better educational opportunity, IEI Director Leslie Boney said. And finally, Food Lion makes generous gift to Food Bank. Food Lion made a $100,000 donation in gift cards to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina for this past holiday season for the bank's 34-county service area. The Food Bank has provided food for people at risk of hunger in 34 counties for 40 years. It serves a network of more than 800 partner agencies such as soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters. And now we turn to the On Healthcare Higher Education page written by Zach Ezone. Lawsuit: Duke others bilked some students. Duke University is accused of price fixing on student aid. Duke University is among 16 private colleges in the U.S. accused of violating antitrust laws in a lawsuit filed in federal court January 9. The complaint claims the universities have participated in a price fixing cartel that has artificially inflated the cost of attendance for students who receive financial aid. The plaintiffs behind the class action suit are seeking an end to the university's conduct and compensation for former students. In short, over almost two decades, defendants have overcharged over 170,000 financial aid recipients by at least hundreds of millions of dollars, the lawsuit claims. Duke declined to comment on the lawsuit January 11. The complaint is centered on the university's current or past participation in the 568 Presidents Group. This is an affiliation of colleges and universities that use common standards to assess an applicant's ability to pay for admission and develop aid packages. Yale University, another school named in the lawsuit, told the Wall Street Journal that the school's financial aid policy is 100% compliant with all applicable laws. Universities are able to engage in these practices through an antitrust law exemption that requires the universities to operate using need-blind admissions. This means an institution cannot consider an applicant's financial situation when deciding on an application. The lawsuit claims the universities have not been complying with the exemption and therefore are violating antitrust laws. For instance, it states 9 of the universities, including Duke, have maintained admission systems that favor the children of wealthy, past, or potential future donors. Additionally, the lawsuit says these 9 universities have given preference to students who don't need financial aid when deciding on waitlist admissions. Garner Psychiatric Facility shuts down after repeated violations. A psychiatric hospital in Garner that has been cited for numerous license violations is closing after reaching a settlement with the state. Strategic Behavioral Health and the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services signed the agreement December 17 that required the center to transfer or discharge all of its patients by December 31, 2021, or as soon as clinically appropriate. The center operated 60 licensed residential beds and 56 licensed acute beds, including 32 for child or adolescent patients and 24 for adults. Along with the patients, the closure affects 150 jobs, according to the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The company will terminate its participation in Medicare and Medicaid on February 1 and pay all outstanding administrative penalties, which total $175,000. As part of the agreement, Strategic has the opportunity to find a third party to take over as operator of the facility. That new operator must apply for its license through the department by June 30. Merger enhances Cato's European footprint. A clinical research company based in Kerry is expanding its reach after completing a merger with a firm based in the United Kingdom. The merger between Cato SMS and UK's Pharmolam will create a new entity employing between 1,300 to 1,400 people across 35 offices in 25 countries. The Triangle, where more than 300 employees are located, will continue to serve as the company's main hub. Dr. Mark Goldberg, the CEO of Cato, says it's these companies that house about 70% of the biopharmaceutical industry's intellectual property. And we have a quote, he said it, new CEO Roger Jeffs, as Liquidia Corporation prepares to launch its new drug, Yutrepia, and is engaged in lawsuits and patent disputes with United Therapeutics, which has a headquarters location in the Triangle. With the Yutrepia launch in sight, we have an opportunity to scale our existing commercial capabilities for this potentially best-in-class inhaled prostacycline therapy and rapidly drive toward profitability. And finally, we have a big number, $40 million to $60 million. That's how much the construction of a 125,000-square-foot medical development near UNC Rex Hospital in Raleigh will cost two local firms and one national firm to develop. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Labor Market Could Be Flushed with Workers Soon. Right before the start of the holiday season in 2021, I wrote a column cautioning that this may not be the right time to take on additional debt. Clearly, one of two things happened. No one read that column or no one cared. Either way, it hurts my feelings, but then again, to heck with feelings. Collectively, we spent a lot of money this holiday season, and from the numbers, it looks like we spent money that we really don't have. The National Retail Foundation estimates holiday sales are on track to grow as much as 11.5% over 2020. About 30% of Americans said they overspent during the gift-giving season, according to a post-holiday survey by WalletHub. Now, if you merge the latest projections with what was going on with the American consumer in the second and third quarters of 2021, the picture becomes more clear. As expected, Americans are running out of money, and the folks who are waiting on the sidelines for things to improve, health concerns, may be forced to come back to the labor force. Let me explain. Despite the gradual increase in overall wages, it is unable to keep up with the increase in prices from groceries to gasoline. CNBC's analysis of wages and prices shows that over the past 2 years, median income fell 3%, while the cost of living rose nearly 7%, due in part to rising housing and medical costs. Now, couple that with the holiday shopping, where more than 80% of the goods were bought by credit card, and the total tab of credit card debt is expected to rise to far more than $1.1 trillion. This is after American consumers spent much of 2020 paying down their credit card bills because they had nowhere to go and nowhere to eat due to the lockdowns. The average U.S. household has a debt of $155,622, and collectively, total debt has now ballooned to more than $15 trillion. The number includes mortgage, credit cards, auto loans, student loans, and lines of credit. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon recently said the personal balance sheets of U.S. consumers is very strong. His comments talked about rising wages, lower debt, increased savings, and a great worker-driven labor market. He is right, but there's one problem. He's looking in the rearview mirror. As I mentioned, inflation-backed increases in consumer goods have zeroed out wage increases. Consumer debt is on the rise, and Americans may have been forced to dip into their savings over the past 2 years. So in essence, only two things can happen. One, people will run out of money, and in order to pay back their rising debt, they will get back into the labor market. Already there are signs of that. In December, the U.S. Department of Labor noted more than 320,000 women joined the workforce, increasing the labor participation rate for women to nearly 58%, a recent high. Two, consumers will disregard their financial situation, thinking additional government help is on the way and new moratoriums will be put in place if the Omicron variant forces unabated hospitalizations and increasing deaths for months to come. Already, TransUnion estimates auto, credit card, and personal loans will be on the increase in 2022. Here's hoping for number one to happen, but then again, maybe all of this simply will go unread. And now we'll turn to some of our general news items. Amazon eyes tech workers in the Triangle. E-commerce giant seeks to hire talent in tight local market. Written by Lauren Onasorge. As Triangle employers battle to fill open tech positions, Amazon is stepping up its hiring game in the region. The e-commerce giant has dozens of postings for on-site developer jobs in the region. About 50 open positions have been listed in the past 2 weeks alone for Raleigh and Durham, a review of job postings shows. They include cloud infrastructure architects and database consultants in Durham and customer solutions managers in Raleigh. Amazon has several locations in the region, including a massive distribution warehouse operation in Garner, but much of its presence so far has been logistics related. One of Amazon's new job postings says the company is in the process of locating office space in the area of North Carolina Research Triangle Park. Amazon did not comment on the hirings. Many of the new positions appear to be for sophisticated technology functions that fall outside the scope of a logistics warehouse. The influx of high technology roles by Amazon comes at a time of mounting competition for local employers. The most recent report from the North Carolina Technology Association shows employers were competing to fill nearly 14,800 job openings in Raleigh alone in the month of November, a 46% increase over the same month in 2020. For the Durham-Chapel Hill Metro, there was nearly 4,500 openings for November. Brooks Rayford, CEO of North Carolina Tech, points to recent economic development wins, such as that of Apple's 3,000-job research and development operation in RTP, as proof of the talent pool is expected to expand. Anytime a large name brand employer enters the market, there's added pressure on existing employers to take steps that keep them attractive to current and prospective employees, Rayford says in an email. As companies make the decision to grow or relocate in our region, they're doing due diligence in evaluating the available talent pool and pipeline, so they must feel confident about those factors. But homegrown technology firms are repeatedly complaining about the tight talent pool. During the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce's launch 2022 in early January, Todd Olson, CEO of software firm Pendo in Raleigh, said local CEOs need to be creative to retain and expand their workforce amid competition from Apple, Google, and Amazon. Higher compensation and stock options are just the minimum, Olson said, describing perks Pendo is offering in order to stand out, such as on-site pizza oven and barista. And we'll end with the Business Pulse survey. The question, has your company fired employees over COVID-19 vaccine mandates? Total number of responses, 168. 59% say, no, we don't have a vaccine mandate. 23% say, no, most to all employees have complied. 13% say yes, several employees have been fired over the mandate, and 5% say yes, but just one or two employees. And it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.